by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it, come in no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler, and Charlotte is off tonight. We're going to be discussing a paper that I wrote and put up on the web on thesecrettruth.com entitled Commies versus Cronies. And what I mean by commies is I'm using that generally as a term of the collective people that believe in socialism to communism, everything in between. And the word crony I'm defining as those that have actually been in control of what we term crony capitalism, or another term would be monopolistic capitalism. But anyway, my white paper is on the secrettruth.com website on the homepage, and you can just scroll down there from the top. In addition, there's an additional paper there called Turkey Intrigue, which I covered last week in a talk there for 1 hour last week. But you can read both of those, and you might find those sort of interesting. I'll have some comments towards the end of this hour program on the Turkey Intrigue article that I wrote, and bring you up to date on what's happening in Turkey. Getting back to this commies versus cronies is that, you know, we started out years ago, and people started thinking in terms of utopians, states and political systems, economic. Everyone was wanting to create a system. Some of the foremost thinkers, in the different countries in Europe and, you know, Great Britain and America and other places throughout the world begin to dwell on certain ideas around of utopia. In other words, the idealist wanted and yearns for a better world, so a perfect world. But is a utopian world possible? Or should we begin to accept a non-perfect world as the real reality? But we have great compassion and love for one another, so we tend to try to want to take and reorder a system, restructure a system, make it more socially acceptable, or attain this word called social justice. When you hear the word social justice, you know for sure that's a hot button word, a key word for socialist communist thinking. And what has actually been going on is that this collective mind, it's hive thinking, see, is another way to describe it. And it mobilizes a large number of people into thinking that somehow they can provide goods and services free to others, and the whole society can move along on a basis of free goods and services. That would be closer to being possible if the real people in control had not suppressed free energy ideas. Now, we're going to lay the free energy ideas aside and discuss really what's been going on in the 20th and the 21st century. Collectivism. You hear that term, and a good friend of mine, Eric Samuelson, put together a study. It's on a site down on an Australian server, and it's entitled A Brief Chronology of Collectivism. And he put that together in 1997 and put it up on a server down there. And it's really enlightening about collectivism. And if you go in there to my article, you can click on it, and drill down into that, he began to see that his chronology revealed to himself and others that communism, which pervades the West, is a spirit, is what was one of his main conclusions. That's Eric Samuelson's conclusions. And I could not further, I would have to agree with that. He broke this down into four parts, a brief chronology of collectivism. And it's really in-depth is what he gets into here. He talks about inalienable rights, which are not taught in school anymore, and they're looked upon from the bench, from within judges, from the bench that judges are on, primarily with scorn, you know. And the Calvinists, he says, take a lead and develop the right of subjects to rebel against secular authority. And then in 1780, Bentham, Jeremy Bentham stated, I dreamed the other night that I was a founder of a sect. He's a real work of art, if you look into what, you know, he stood for, which neither Eric nor I would stand, you know, stand for what he stood for. The Enlightenment abandoned biblical revolution for reason and sensationalism. And today, this idea of collectivism is centered around pragmatism thinking. And ethics, they're talking about, you know, ethics instead of immutable truth. They're talking about a mutable truth. A social and moral type of truth is what many can and have described it as. Children who are very young, they know how to think for themselves, but society conditions and educates them into something else. Dewey denied there was any such thing as absolute truth, the great educator, and that everything was relative and everything was doubtful and there was no basic values. But as early as 1927, in this country, it was estimated that we had no fewer than 10 million laws and ordinances in the United States. And by 1947, it was said that the prevailing teaching of both political and legal philosophers, they denied that the purpose of government is to secure these inherent and inalienable rights. So they started changing many of the founding principle ideas. Early on, you could say, the absolute truths, you could say, that will be established by natural law and natural rights. They're not being taught anymore, see. And this natural rights have been replaced by human rights. And you start looking at where that is coming from, you're going to find it centered around the UN, see. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But they're not based upon, say, natural rights. See, we get back to, let me just say something here about natural rights for a few minutes here. A friend of mine, who is a strong gun control advocate, was reminding me about the Second Amendment, and it says a well-regulated, militia thing. And, I had to get back on the right to keep and bear arms is based upon a natural right that is inherent in each and every one of us, and that's the right to protect ourselves, see. Now, he said, yeah, but what about this that says the well-regulated militia? This is the answer that I gave him. I said, okay, let's create a hypothetical situation where you're a member of a well-regulated militia. And let's say that you're on your way to a meeting that's being held of this well-regulated militia, and you're armed because, you know, everyone's going to drill and they're going to take their arms with them. And let's say you're walking down the road to attend this meeting and someone tries to attack you. Well, you're armed. What are you going to do? He said, I'm going to protect myself. I said, yes. That gets back to the inherent natural right you have to keep and bear arms, which is self-protection. And he thought a while and he said, yeah, he's sort of right. So they'll come at us with a lot of different arguments, but it's hard to undo that real core natural right idea. And from that springs natural rights, or that natural law idea. And from that springs natural rights. See, we've been indoctrinated. I mean, we go to school. We're programmed there. They teach us what we're supposed to learn there. We get up and we swear allegiance to the flag every morning, which I certainly believe in. But then that's part of this conditioning that we begin to get used to, see. But we don't really think about much outside and above that, because we're young and we're just going along and getting along and being educated. In Great Britain, the Fabian Society was founded in London on March the 14th, 1884. And it was created as a means to create a mechanism to transform Great Britain into a socialist state. The society was named after Quintus Fabius Maximus. He died on December 31st, 45 BC. He was a general and politician of the late Roman Republic. And he was considered to be a founder of guerrilla warfare, for he attacked the enemy's supply lines and used delaying tactics to defeat the enemy. Now, the name of the Fabian Society then is named after him, because what they did was, the first crest of the Fabian Society was a wolf in sheep's clothing, and later a logo was created, and it was a TARDIS with the inscription on the shell, "Where I strike hard." But this delaying characteristic of Fabianism conjures up the concept of protracted conflict, or the Chinese concept of protracted people's war. And that's basically what the Fabian socialists, they call them, were out to do, was to slowly, incrementally transform England into a socialist communist state. The only problem that we have in Great Britain today is that we have in the UK, United Kingdom, a socialist state, and there's a lot of benefits from that. But the economy is no longer as efficient as it has been. Thus, the cost of maintaining that socialist state is beginning to be untenable, and it's not affordable any longer. So it's changing. UK is changing and taking away from some of those benefits. Later, Edward Mandel House, in the early 1900s, he was a Fabian socialist, and he was the author of Philip Drew Administrator, and that projected a very totalitarian type of government. And he was full of collective ideas as a result of his thinking. Later on, he was a Texan, but he would move to New York City, and there he would gain the friendship of Woodrow Wilson, who was the governor of New Jersey. He became later a close advisor, and he helped to establish the Federal Reserve System, and which is our central bank. And he also helped establish the Council on Foreign Relations. In advising Woodrow Wilson, there's a history about how this Federal Reserve System came about, and The Creature of Jekyll Island by G. Edward Griffin would be what I could refer you to seek out and find that book. And I think GCN Network has a special. They'll send you a silver dollar and a book for so many dollars. But that's probably the best way to buy that book. And so Edward Mandel House, coming out of Houston by way of Austin to New York and then the White House and then Washington, D.C., became a very, very influential figure. And then out of that, Woodrow Wilson came this privately owned Federal Reserve System. We hear the word in my paper here, commies versus cronies. And pejorative term, the word commie has become a pejorative term as perceived by the left. Some of the rights would use that word to denigrate certain people of that belief, that political belief. But also, you could say if you hear someone say that word, then McCarthyism is conjured up, it seems like, from out of nowhere. The Bolshevik Revolution, okay, was financed by the cronies or the ultra-capitalist, the banking system. And it was to establish a communist state in Russia. And this money that they had, they wanted to disrupt the war. And Germany was behind some of the early funding of some of the figures that promulgated the Bolsheviki Revolution in Russia to be disruptive because of World War One. The Russians, centered around Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky, would dominate the politics of this emerging Russia after they consolidated their power around the Communist Party. Before that, though, they established a secret police called the Cheka. And the Cheka was an example of the ruthlessness that the Soviets utilized to consolidate their power, okay? And there's a quote out of one of their gazettes or one of their newspapers, okay? And here I will quote directly from the Krasnaya Gazeta, which means the Red Gazette, the Red Gazette newspaper. And here's a quote. "We will turn our hearts into steel, which we will temper in the fire of suffering and the blood of fighters for freedom. We will make our hearts cruel, hard, and immovable, so that no mercy will enter them, and so that they will not quiver at the sight of a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of that sea without mercy, without sparing. We will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands. Let them drown themselves in their own blood, for the blood of Lenin and Yuriski and Zonovalov and Volodarsky. Let there be floods of the blood of the bourgeois. More blood as much as possible." Close of quotes. These people that set up this Bolshevik Revolution were very ruthless, and they spilled blood just, you know, left and right without... It was terrible what happened there. A man by the name of Anthony Sutton, a British subject, came to America and started working for foundations. And he was quite an intellectual and scholar, okay? He authored a series of books, and one of those was entitled Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. And that book basically was an indictment of international financiers who financed the Bolshevik Revolution. And in fact, in 1917, Leon Trotsky was living in New York at that time, and he was placed on a steamer to Russia, to Petrograd. And what I have in my paper are several excerpts from that book. And I know one of the interesting bits of information here is Woodrow Wilson was president at the time with Edward Mandel House as his primary advisor. And Woodrow Wilson provided passports to about six or seven was Trotsky and six or seven of his comrades. And so they, when they entered Russia that year, they entered in 1917 through Finland into Russia. They were carrying American passports. And there was some commotion there. The Stockholm legation cabled the State Department on June 13, 1917, just after Trotsky crossed the Finnish-Russian border. And here's what they cabled the State Department. Legation confidentiality informed Russia, English, and French passport offices at Russian frontier, Tarnaya, considerably worried by passage of suspicious persons bearing American passports. So, Anthony Sutton in this book sets out the facts. And basically, your biggest money, Wall Street and London, and German interests, financed the Bolshevik Revolution. And it became very, very big and a big successful because of the bloodthirsty and the ruthlessness of the Russian communists. McCarthyism, Joe McCarthy. Let's get into some interesting aspects in the 50s when he was making all these allegations. There was the army, out of the army came code breakers, okay? After World War I especially. And it actually evolved into the Army Security Agency, which I was part of in the 60s, in the mid-60s, 63, 64, and 65. There was a code-breaking service that was set up that was beginning to look at the information and the messages, the encoded messages, to the Rosenberg spy ring in New York City and other spies throughout America. The name of that project, okay, was the Venona Project. And it began in 1943. But 2 years later, the Army Security Agency was founded in 1945 and took over that code-breaking project, okay? The Rosenbergs later on, it would be revealed, were stealing nuclear secrets from New Mexico, where we were developing the hydrogen bomb. And even out there, there were spies working for the Russians. But in this, I get into McCarthyism and what he was trying to expose. And some of what he was saying was very true. And it's backed up by the Venona, you could say, project. There is something in here, too, that was very interesting, that Joe McCarthy was accusing that there were Trotskyites in the State Department, and the Venona Project and those intercepts were released to the public in 1995, and they proved without a doubt, yes, there were Trotskyites and communist agents in our State Department, just like Joe McCarthy was alleging. And the Venona transcripts, which were released by the NSA, National Security Agency, in 1995, prove that. There was an interesting individual that is weaving his way in and out of this period before and after World War II. His name was C.D. Jackson. Okay. Before the war, he worked for the Luces. They were founders of Time Life, but they were also members of the Synergist movement. Okay. And the Synergist movement was a movement, you could say, of secret society members who control political systems from behind the scenes. And that's basically what's been going on, is that the secret society bunch have been manipulating and controlling most of our political systems. And they're the ones that have been taking over ownership of our central banks, including the Federal Reserve. And you could say they're international bankers in a broad description. I have a description, a bio of him in this paper that you can click on that came out of Spartacus Education. And it's an in-depth. He was CIA connected. He also was the one that was behind going after Joe McCarthy. That's where he also, in addition to that, he led the American delegation to the first Bilderberg Group meeting, which was at the Bilderberg Hotel in the Netherlands. And the CIA at that time was behind financing that first meeting. And C.D. Jackson was CIA connected agent since 1948. Since the CIA was not there in right quite there. He from the beginning, yeah, I would have to say from the beginning. Now, the Rosenberg, let's get back to this Rosenberg spy ring, okay? this spy ring was secretly operating in New York City and so forth. And we broke the code. The U.S. Army inherited originally the U.S. Army's Signal Intelligence Service was working on this Venona project. It was taken over in 1945 by the Army Security Agency, what is by the agency I was in. And it took from 1945 to end of 1947 to begin to break the KGB codes and undercovering and identifying some of the first members of those spy groups. I have click off here into NSA site, okay, and I'll just read you directly off their site. The U.S. Army's Signal Intelligence Service, the precursor to the National Security Agency, began a secret program in February 1943, later codenamed Venona. Well, they didn't say that we were the ones that preceded the NSA, and the Army Security Agent actually preceded the formation of the National Security Agency. They go on to say the mission of this small program was to examine and exploit Soviet diplomatic communications, but after the program began, the message traffic included espionage efforts as well. And they go on to say that it took almost 2 years before American cryptologists were able to break the KGB encryption. The information gained through these translations provided U.S. leadership insight into Soviet intentions and treasonous activities of government employees until the program was canceled in 1980. So right there, they're saying that there were government employees that were spying for the Soviets at the time. There, in my paper here, I included a secret Venona intercepts by Tiffany Danitz. And it's a very nice article that which I included embedded in this article. So that's very important to read, and she lays it out real well. Also, in addition, there's a list from the Venona papers after they were released in 1995. There was a list put together on Wikipedia of 200 Americans and so forth that were owned or involved or were cited or was or there were messages to that were secretly encoded by the Russians to American spies. And so if you'll go into this paper that I have on my site, Charlotte and my Our site, thesecrettruth.com, you'll see that and you'll find a list from Wikipedia of about 200 people involved, and at the bottom are footnotes, references, and so forth that will back up the names. There's also down there at the bottom of this external links to the NSA Venona site and selected Venona messages. You can go in there and read the messages yourself and so forth. But what forever and an age. We have all of these students coming in, and they've been drilled like parrots, you know, like you train parrots. McCarthyism, McCarthyism, McCarthyism. The Venona transcripts and intercepts prove beyond a doubt that Joe McCarthy was right with much of what he was saying. I think there were some inaccuracies at times that he did state, but his overall premise that there were Trotskyites and communist agents working in our government and there were spies, American spies, working for the Russians, has proven to be right spot on. So, you know, one of my little sayings is that the world is a jungle full of parrots. And I'll never forget that it took a number of years, but one day you could say I was a parrot, and I was parroting all of these things I'd been taught and in school and college and so forth. And then I started studying the other side of the history, the alternative history, you could say. And it began to wake up. I started getting on the web in 1986. I built my first computer. And I started looking, and then we didn't have the web. We had bulletin board systems, and you could go in and read files and so forth. But then I began to write and begin my first book. I was written back then, and I also a few years later, a couple of years later, I did some research and wrote a book called Time Dynamism, on a theory on space time. But, and so out of that, I began to theorize, and to speak about the field system that we are embedded in, or we exist inside of. And in that field system, I begin to see things differently and how we were programmed by what I call streams of light. See, and what I say is that when you're looking at an object, just say you're looking at a salt shaker on a table in a restaurant, and you see that image, and you have been taught perhaps to previous or had previous experience about what that is. But that stream of light coming into the mind then is the way that that object is conveyed, see. So that stream of light is an idea. Well, somewhere in the brain, depending on your storage capacity, the brain's physiology and so forth, that stream of light is recorded and stored, see. So it's this ability of the mind of the brain to take in these streams of light, which are ideas, and to store those ideas. And perhaps to associate and compare them with other previous ideas of other previous salt shakers. So you could say there's an overlapping occurs. If you take strips of film of and both say, let's just assume here that both strips of film contain a salt shaker. You take those strips of film and start overlaying them and saying, hey, this is similar, or it's the same salt shaker, see. So the mind is continuously comparing these images and these streams of light and these ideas against each other. And it functions something about like I was describing. No one knows exactly, see, how that all works. But we can only try to hypothesize and try to imagine the way that the mind works. In this struggle to ascertain this thing called truth, which is very difficult and very elusive. Yeah, it's very difficult to attain. But so we have to take away these biases. My last book called Be Good to Yourself had a list of biases in the back of it. And we're biased by so many different things and different mechanisms and so forth. We exclude information. So there's an exclusion bias. There's a it goes on and on. See, we're predisposed. This is really one of our major problems, is that in this way of maturing and developing and learning and being, you know, coached by our parents, educated by our schools, and then indoctrinated within our churches or whatever, we come up with a worldview, see, as best we can, of what we believe to be the truth about reality, see. And so we begin to try to imagine, see, what this thing called reality is, so that we can find our place in there and try to attain happiness, see. So it's not easy always, and there's many trials and tribulations before we can try to establish something that is on the par of peace and prosperity and meaning, see. It's not easy, and we just must continue on. In this collective idea, there's many ideas, but one of the ideas and isms that I discovered along the way was what is described as communitarianism. And Nikki Rapana, in my research, I came across her on the web and started reading her page, and I said, oh my gosh, she and her daughter, Nardica, started writing, prolifically on communitarianism. And basically, it's a trap, it's an end run around freedom and liberty. But because of what it basically does is that it defines the community rights as superior to individual rights. So right there, when you start subscribing to this thing called communitarianism, then you're laying aside and setting aside much of what was incorporated in our Bill of Rights. See, so there's end runs around and the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that have been proffered out there to destroy our principal ideas, the founding principles and ideas that this country was founded on. The problem that the elite of the world have in our Declaration, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights is that it is about the best system devised by man to provide, you could say, a government that has control, a division, the branches, the three different branches, and so forth, and voting. So it combined a democratic process with the republic, which the republic was established by the protection of individual rights and freedoms because of the Bill of Rights against the majority. See, de Tocqueville came to this country from France and did a study of America in the 1800s. And one of the things he pointed out to the readers of his publications and his work was that the tyranny of the majority is real. So any time that a majority, exclusively a majority, votes, then they can begin to vote themselves benefits. And that's what's happened in this country, is that our politicians have provided to the voters what they want. And it's undermined our budgets, and it's increased our tax burdens, and they just give them more and more. It's in Rome they were giving people free bread. One of the more recent current examples is in Egypt, when they had all that Arab Spring over there. They were finding pieces of bread all over the street, and then someone seemed to say, "Hey, what is this bread doing? The people are hungry, and what these pieces of bread?" Well, the bread that was on the streets was a subsidized bread by the government. So a person would buy a real cheap piece of bread for a few cents, eat a piece of it, and throw the rest away, see? So whenever you have bread, okay, like this subsidized bread, you're buying rights and you're buying votes with it, just like in Rome, see? And today, the votes, see, the politicians are getting the votes, and those votes are buying benefits and entitlement programs. And it's undermining the economics and the budgeting of this country. So communitarianism was an end run around it. And Nikki Rapana got onto this in Portland, Oregon, when her landlord came to her and he said, "They've got this community membership thing, you know, a neighborhood organization, and they're asking me to do this, this, and this, and I don't really have the money to do that, and I don't want to do that, but they seem to be forcing me into this." And that's how Nikki Rapana got on to this communitarian movement. So there's a lot of isms out there. And I always say that you know, you've got to that isms are control mechanisms. See, that's what it's about. And so you've got to try to come out of the isms and look at things in an objective way. Okay. Now let's move on to the word cronies and crony capitalism. And, you know, you could use this word in a lot of ways, like crony capitalism, monopolistic capitalism, Babylonian capitalism is another way of saying it. And they mean about the same thing, and basically it's a monopoly of money creation and tyrannical operations. But because it is a monopoly, then it has characteristics of criminal and tyrannical operations, see. Now, in my studies, I found something very interesting. I was studying humanism, see. And I call myself a humanitarianism, not a humanist, see, because I'm still God-centered, see. But anyway, in my studies, I found a book on humanism, and it's a pretty good book, really. And it's written by Carlos Lamont, okay? And I didn't think anything about it. And later on, I was in my study of The Creature of Jekyll Island. I ran across the name of Thomas W. Lamont. And Thomas W. Lamont was the first vice president of J.P. Morgan, who went down to Jekyll Island in the early 1900s, before 1913, and helped to establish the Federal Reserve System, see. And it's just a misnomer. It was named that to make people think it was federal, an agency of the government. But it's not. It's privately owned by the banks. So anyway, Thomas W. Lamont was the father of Carlos Lamont. Now, it so happens that the Lamont family was playing both sides of the divide. The commies were represented by Carlos Lamont, who was a communist socialist, okay? And then his father was a New York banker, a first vice president of J.P. Morgan, but he also was a fascist supporter. He thought a lot of Mussolini, and prior to World War II, arranged a $100 million loan to Mussolini and his government. So the dialectic that I'm trying to point out here is that we're seeing that the cronies have been behind the collective communist movement all this time. And the Fabian, you know, movement is another society was a beginning in Great Britain or UK. And the reason why is that they want to use this collective state to control people through entitlement and benefit programs, see. And that's how the capstone at the top that will resembles international financiers that have a monopoly of money creation. And that all the time they've been creating this dialectic of conflict between the collective thinkers, the communists and socialists, you dedicated people working for the poor and downtrodden to bring about a communist state of which the ultra-capitalists won't, see. But they'll also always maintain control over the money creation system. And even one of the 10 planks in communism was a central bank, okay? And so, and when you see that, you talk about that type of capitalism, then you talk about state capitalism, see. In other words, the communists that finally took over and consolidated their power in Russia still had made use of the capital of the state. See, so it was state capitalism is what they were utilizing to maintain control and to fund their government. See, so there's a lot of twists and turns in this thing, and it's tricky. See, it's not that easy to decipher or to decrypt, if you want to use decryption type of words. But crony capitalism then has been used, see, and actually in my little paper here, I designate the city of London, the financial city of London, as the crony fortress, see. And there the money manifests, you know, in the likes of great financial, insurance, brokerage firms and so forth. And it just dominates the world economics. And it is the primary financial center still of the world. There are other centers that are gaining influence, but the city of London, there's about a square mile area in there, 1.1 square miles, and it is still dominant worldwide of financial dealings throughout the world on an international basis. E.C. Newt wrote a book called The Empire of the City, and I've included it in there, in this paper. And here's one of his excerpts, is that the city is an international financial oligarchy and is perhaps the most arbitrary and absolute form of government in the world. This international financial oligarchy uses the allegoric crown as its symbol of power and has its headquarters in the ancient city of London, an area downtown London, okay. And so forth. It has its own police force and so forth. If you go into my article, I have a click off there, okay? And it's actually a corporation. The City of London is actually a corporate entity. And I have a click off in there about the City of London. And it's on their site. It's their site. And they tell all about their city and the incorporation and so forth. So we see that has been carried over to this country, and many of our cities have been incorporated for that reason, see. And we don't always have the full accounting unless we get a comprehensive financial statement from these entities that have been incorporated, see. But anyway, that's in there, and it's interesting to go in and drill down into that, and you can learn more about the City of London. Very powerful. And also, if you click off on the top of the Empire of the City, by Newt, you're going to find his whole book on the internet. You can read that book, the whole book, besides just these excerpts that I have in there. Okay. I also have in here statement by Cicero about traitors and treasonous individuals. And it goes like this. We're beginning the quotes. A nation can survive its fools and even the ambitious, but it cannot survive treason from within. An enemy at the gates is less formidable, for it is known and carries his banner openly. But the traitor moves among those within the gates freely, his sly whispers rustling through all the alleys, heard in the very halls of government itself. For the traitor appears not as a traitor. He speaks in accents familiar to his victims, and he wears their face and their garments. He appeals to the baseness that lies deep in the hearts of all men. He rots the soul of a nation. He works secretly and unknown in the night to undermine the pillars of the city. He infects the body politic so that it can no longer resist. A murderer is less to fear. The traitor is the plague. And that was a fine quote by Cicero, living in Rome, 103 to 43 B.C. He was a tremendous Roman statesman, philosopher, and orator. And he makes several statements and orators about the natural law also. So he's quite a man to follow and to quote. I mean, and with that far back, boy, they really had the wisdom, didn't they? Now, we move on to other things in this article. And from Russia with Money was a study recently published, okay? And it's about Hillary's foundation, I believe, and so forth. And that's something to really get into and read. It's in there, and you can download that. It gets in the executive summary states, a major technology transfer component of the Russian reset, overseen by Hillary Clinton, substantially enhanced the Russian's military technological capabilities, according to both the FBI and the U.S. Army. And these are the hot points here I'm reading. There's four more. Russian government officials and American corporations participated in the technology transfer project overseen by Hillary Clinton's State Department that funneled tens of millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation. Another one. A Putin-connected Russian government fund transferred $35 million to a small company with Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, as its executive board, which included senior Russian officials. Another hot point. John Podesta failed to reveal, as required by law, his federal financial disclosures, his membership on the board of this offshore company. And the last one is that Podesta also headed up a think tank which wrote favorably about the Russian reset while apparently receiving millions from the Kremlin-linked Russian oligarchs via an offshore LLC. Anyway, you'll find that whole PDF file in this paper. We've got to be careful in the future. This country has been taken over by international elites, and it's like when there's a involuntary takeover or a forced takeover of a corporation by an adversary that goes in and starts selling off the corporation and breaking it to pieces. And that's basically what we're seeing happen in this country right now. I wrote a very simple aphorism a number of years ago, and it goes like this, and it sort of describes the system overall in a nutshell. Here's the way it goes. Physical superiority orchestrating money, mind sorcery. And basically, how that breaks down is that the people that control the United States and most of the Western world are heavily, of course, into the financial institutions. But they also have dominance over most governments. Well, these governments, they have to maintain and research and continue to develop the greatest weapon systems so they can maintain what I designated there as physical superiority. Now, they've coupled that over the ages with what I call money sorcery. And it's a monopoly of money and credit creation by owning of the central banks. Okay. Now, in addition to that, I set out a mind sorcery. And what mind sorcery consists of is the practice of all mind control methods, see. So the elites have gone in and they divided it, the commies from the cronies, or the collectivists against the cronies. And with this dialectic playing out, it transforms the freedom and liberty seeking public to a world slave state of communist collective thought, using full spectrum dominance techniques and so forth. And so we're just used so much. I mean, we're not even aware sometimes of how we've been used and abused, and we've been rode hard, as they say in Texas, and put up wet. You know what I mean? If you're talking about cowboy lingo, and my relatives were the first cowboys in Texas out of Gonzales area. So we come from a long line of cowboys over the decades here in Texas. Erdogan is an interesting. Let's get back to the article on Turkey intrigue. Now I'm going to finish the last 5, 6, 7 minutes here, bringing you up to date on what's going on in Turkey. Is that Erdogan started changing his policies before this coup occurred in July. And he started wanting to become friendly again with Russia and to make friendship with the Israelis again, which he had divided somewhat, had parted with because of the boat incidents there, of those 9 people killed on one of those boats that were taking supplies to Gaza, to the Palestinians. But he started patching up some of those things. And also at the one major problem that Erdogan has committed was that there's evidence there, very strong evidence, that he and some of his close colleagues started trading gold for oil and gas with the Iranians when the sanctions were still in place. The sanctions were put on by the European Union and the United States. And what it did was close down a large amount of trade with the Iranians, because it was to try to stop them from developing a nuclear capability and nuclear weapons systems. The Obama administration with John Kerry has recently, in this last year, negotiated a settlement with the Iranians and so forth, and which many of the Republicans in Congress were against. So now there's been recent scandal that there was $400 million delivered to Iran for the release of the 4 Americans that had been detained over there. And I believe that's spot on. One of the released Americans was in the airport there in Iran, and they had to wait until the plane with the $400 million was there and landed and unloaded, and then they let them come back to the States. Erdogan has this tremendous arrest, detaining, dismissing, stopping 50,000 passports, canceling those, and so forth. So he's also, you could say, has pivoted to the Soviet Union. And so he's seeking a closer relationship with Putin. And there's evidence now that Putin notified Erdogan several months before the coup and gave him a list of 2,000 military personnel that were in on the coup. And the story goes that Erdogan approached the judges to get arrest warrants that needed to go through the right procedure, and the judges turned him down because possibly the judges were involved in this coup that was up and coming. And then the coup members began to get little cold water, cold feet, see, and it was originally put together by supposedly American CIA with some military people, and then the Gulen network or movement was behind the scenes, and so that's basically. But it did not work, and Erdogan got wind of it early on from the Russians. He was able to thwart the uprising and the coup, and to put it down and to come out on top. And what he was trying to do was that this trading of gold for the oil and gas in 2011, 12, 13 was being uncovered by his adversaries, his opponents, through the writing of articles. Well, he went out and jailed many of those journalists and newspaper writers that were writing to expose his involvement, see. And so, but he was able to suppress that long enough to still hold the public in general in supportive of him. And so that's why when this coup occurred, he was able to put out into the streets a large number of the public, which still had faith in Erdogan's and did not know fully about some of the problems that he had with the Iranian and Turkish trading in violation of these sanctions. See, but it got to be so much money. I think there was one AKP party member that was a close associate of Erdogan. He was head of president of one of the largest banks over there. Had $4.5 million in shoeboxes at home. And the story goes that he was arrested, taken away, and, you know, beginning to be charged and all this. And then later, Erdogan had the power to dismiss judges and prosecutors and so forth, the police officials, to where he was finally released back to his home, and they gave him back the $4.5 million. That's what we're up against now. We're going to see that Erdogan's going to turn further to the Soviets relationship. He's pivoting to the Soviets. He's not going to be as cooperative in NATO. In fact, the NATO might be getting ready to undergo a very, very big change. And that big change could occur with him dropping out of NATO or taking a lesser role or not coming through with his obligations of NATO. The EU has been very cold on him being admitted to the European Union. He's wanted to join the European Union for a while, but was never allowed. I did some additional research, and the economy of Turkey is deteriorating from 2010 forward. The last 5-6 years, it's been deteriorating, and the net international investment position is also deteriorating. So it's not quite what it used to be. Well, look, I want to thank each and every one of you for listening tonight. And we're going to be signing off in about 15, 20 seconds here. But anyway, go to thesecrettruth.com. You can read both articles, or you can get this off of the website. It's on demand, and it goes air broadcast Saturday night here in Austin on 89.1. But thank you very much for listening, and I wish each and every one of you the best, and good luck, and God bless you. Good night.